I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Joining me now is Tim Ryan, the veteran broadcaster, who's on to discuss his memoir On Someone Else's Nickel, A Life in Television, Sports, and Travel. It's a terrific book that talks of his 50-year career in television, covering 10 Olympic Games, over 300 championship boxing matches, Wimbledon and U.S. Open tennis matches, World Cup skiing, and much more. To say he's versatile is an understatement. He also talks in his book about the colorful people he's encountered in the booth, as well as on the field or the court. He discusses his late wife, Lee, and her battle with early-onset Alzheimer's disease. There's just so much in the book. I had a lot of fun talking to Tim late last month. He was born in Winnipeg, growing up in Toronto, and then he was educated at Notre Dame and soon went to the United States working in hockey in Oakland before doing the evening news at WPIX, New York City's Channel 11, then NBC Sports, and going on to do the New York Rangers hockey broadcasts and the Islanders, including two of their championship seasons starting in 1979-80. After that followed nearly 20 years at CBS Sports. Then before going back to NBC, he did some work for ESPN. He wrapped up a 52-year career with the 2012 London Summer Olympic Games. Tim joined me from his home in Victoria, where he lives with his wife, Patricia. It's a city he knows well, as his father, Joe Ryan, a legendary CFL manager, retired to that city in the late 1960s, receiving accolades like induction into the Canadian Football Hall of Fame and Canada's Sports Hall of Fame. Tim's book is published by Radius Book Group, which is an imprint of Diversion Publishing. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Tim Ryan. Mr. Ryan, good morning.
Good morning, Joseph. Pleasure to be with you.
Nice to talk to you. Where were you born?
Winnipeg.
Yeah, Winnipeg, okay. And so I've reached you in Victoria, pardon me, today. But you went to school at Notre Dame, is that right?
Yes, I grew up in Toronto after brief stops as an infant, born in Winnipeg and during the war years in Ottawa, and then a few years afterwards in Montreal, and my father's football career taking us to those cities. And then I grew up in Toronto, went to the finish of my elementary school and high school there at De La Salle, Oakland, and then I went off to college at Notre Dame.
And because people will know you from obviously television, but I guess you got your start. Was that at the Star in Toronto?
Yes, when I was just starting college, I was able to. The first kind of interest I had was in journalism as a news guy, and so I was a copy boy at Canadian Press one summer, and then at the Toronto Star, in the following summer. Those would have been between my sophomore and junior years at Notre Dame. And I was really planning on taking a job that was waiting for me at the Star as a news reporter, after graduation in 1960. But that kind of turned into a television opportunity and ultimately a television career.
I guess there were, obviously you worked in television in Toronto, but there weren't as many, I guess, opportunities, if you will, in Canada than there were in the United States. A lot of people of your generation, even people from older than you, like Lauren Green and others, went to the States. Do you wonder, though, Tim, if you'd stayed here, what you might have ended up doing?
Well, that's a good question. I think you've kind of put your finger on it in your preamble to that. The fact is that I felt fairly quickly after I started at CFTO when it went on the air in 1961, and I was there for 5 years, almost 6 years, that the ceiling was a little low in Canada for what I had by then had decided I wanted to be full-time in television. And obviously, yes, there were a lot of different examples from my era. Peter Jennings, Morty Safer, a number of others that don't readily come to mind who I was aware of had left Canadian broadcasting for bigger and better opportunities in the U.S. And I kind of thought, well, part of it was the influence, obviously, of having spent 4 years in college in the U.S. in South Bend, Indiana, at Notre Dame. And the great thing about that college was that it was a national school with students from all over, not just from one particular state or area of the country. And so those, that kind of influence of being in the U.S. for 4 years, and that what I refer to as a kind of low ceiling in the broadcasting business in Canada, when I got a chance to go, which was the NHL expansion in 1967, I really decided, let's go for this.
And that was in San Francisco, right?
Yes. Well, it wasn't actually in San Francisco. It was across the Bay Bridge in Oakland, but the San Francisco Bay Area. And, the hockey team, the Oakland, the California Seals, they were called the first year, playing in Oakland.
You know, some people might read your book, Tim, and think that, luck played a part of in the success that you managed to have over the years. But, in reading the book, there's a lot of hard work, isn't there, along the way?
Well, there is, but you're quite right to use the term luck. And lots of young people ask all of us who are broadcasters, we're in sports or news, how do you get to be you? How do you get to have a job in TV broadcasting of sports or news? And my answer is always the first thing is, there's no formula. There's a lot to do with luck and timing, and I acknowledge both of those things in my case. But once you have got a shot, then the real work really begins to maintain your job and your chance for advancement. It's a time-consuming, but no more so than any other profession. I think it's glamorized, but yes, it requires a lot of hard work to be good at it.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things that I found fascinating, that in terms of the preparation that one would do, say, for a, whether it's a boxing match or an NFL game. Let's say you had one to call a week from now. What would your week look like in terms of the preparation? I mean, you just don't show up at an hour before game day and put on the jacket and put on the bike or hold the bike,
no.
Right?
That would be great if it's possible, but it's not. And you picked the toughest example is football, because you're talking about 90 players on the field at different times in any given game. So the work began on Monday, usually looking back at the videos of what you've done the previous day and Sunday to mainly critique yourself. Sometimes in the earlier days at NBC with the executive producer, who would make phone calls to the announcers and give them his critiques as well. And then on Tuesday, you're really starting to get ready totally for the game coming up the following Sunday. And that would involve looking at videos of the two teams who played on that previous Sunday. Then talking, these are the older days, because everything's computerized now. But in the old days, you'd be on the telephone with the PR guys from each team to find out about injuries, et cetera, changes at positions and so on. And then on Wednesday, you put your spotting boards together, putting all the players down on. And now, again, it's all computerized. In those days, you'd use a file folder, or everybody had kind of their own gimmick to make their spotting boards out. Thursday, you would be getting ready to travel, depending on where your game is. Friday, you would arrive in the town where the game's going to be played, and meet with your producer and your fellow analyst, your expert analyst, and maybe socialize a little bit that night. And then Saturday you would be at the home team practice to talk to the coaches and the players, and then meet with the visiting team when they arrive later in the afternoon. And then Sunday is the game, and Sunday nights you're back on the plane to start over for the next week.
Because I do listen to broadcasts, even though I'm not a sports fan, because I'm a fan of broadcasting. The sort of chemistry that people have in the booth, I mean, you can't fake that, can you?
No, I think some of them work pretty automatically and quickly. Others are a struggle, and I think to people who really pay close attention as viewers, they can kind of tell whether the match is good between the play-by-play guy and the analyst. And the fact is that the play-by-play people are full-time broadcasters, and the analysts who come on are almost always former players who have a name from their good play or their coaches. They might have been coaches. And they need to have the support of the pro, if you will, sitting next to them. And sometimes that's there, sometimes it's not. And when they do click, it's great fun for both guys. And sometimes it's not the best relationship. I don't mean in terms of friendship, just that,
sure,
you know, they just don't connect as a pleasing pair on the air. And the audiences pick up on that pretty quickly.
And I read in the book that you're not a fan of, say, three people in the booth, right?
Absolutely not. That's clutter. There's too much talk. There's too much talk these days when there are only two. That's a big complaint of mine now as I watch. But the three in the booth, I did it a few times just because I was, you know, asked to do or told to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I was never comfortable, and I haven't listened to any three-team group on any sport that I thought worked. It just winds up being way too much talk and much of it redundant.
Now, when the great Vin Scully was in the booth for the Dodgers all those years, it was just him. Did you ever try something like that in your career, say?
Well, really only one time that I can recall, but as you know from the book, I've covered 30 different sports, and a lot of them, you know, were one-offs. But I think that the ones that I recall where I was working by myself, early days in Toronto, actually calling Toronto Maple Leafs baseball when they were a Triple-A team in the International League. I was calling them off a ticker tape,
mm-hmm,
from a studio on Richmond Hill by myself with sound effects. You know, that was the really old days of style. But not too many other sports after that. I think a speed skating event in Norway, which wound up not going on air for a bunch of reasons. But I really you look forward to having somebody to play off, and somebody who is the expert in the sport that the fans really want to hear. They want to hear the expertise more than my job is to tell them what's happening on the field as they are watching, and the expert should be explaining the why.
What is it like for you to watch sport now on television? I mean, are there certain things that you're sort of watching for or even listening for, say?
Well, I think, you know, I guess this is probably true of most people who retire from any activity. You pretty quickly become critical of those who follow. So I watch sometimes I'm swearing at the tube or telling them to, you know, stop talking so much and, you know, how could you miss that kind of thing? It's pretty hard not to. I just looked up at the screen here as I'm talking to you, and it looks like there's a replay of an NFL game on as I'm speaking. And if I were, really paying attention to that, no doubt I would find things to be critical about and things that I would be applauding. You know, well done, well said.
Terry Bradshaw is obviously a big star in terms of broadcasting now. Did he start with you?
I had him in his year two. He had on with another announcer at CBS. We were both at CBS. He didn't do terribly well in his rookie year, and they gave him to me in the second year when he was in the booth, you know, not the studio.
Uh-huh.
And I worked very hard with Terry. I liked him immediately. I'd obviously watched him play, and he was a colorful athlete and great talent. And I was really pleased to get to know him. He was quite insecure when he started, and I think that was part of the problem. And I don't think he had the right kind of support from the announcer alongside him, who shall remain nameless, in the first year that he was at CBS. And I was kind of flattered by management that they thought that I could, you know, help him. They thought he had great potential, and so did I.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a good season together to the point that they wound up taking that huge personality and moving him to the studio ultimately. And, of course, that's how he's become known once the NFL rights changed to Fox. You know, he became a star and still is with the pregame show.
Yeah. I want to go back for a sec here to your life in the late 1960s. In particular, the year 1969, you're at Channel 11 in New York, PIX 11, I guess, which we get here on in Vancouver on Shaw. Just what sort of town was it then? I mean, it just seems like an exciting, an exciting city. What with the Mets and the Jets and of course the nightlife there, right?
Everything about it was exciting for me to be there, living and working in New York. We had, of course, my wife and four children. We had found a house in a suburban area called Larchmont in Westchester County, and I commuted in every day to do the nightly news because I was a news anchor. I was hired as a news anchor with another announcer, and then I also would read the sports scores. And again, all the formats are different now, but the politics going on in that year in New York was great. They had a mayoral election with John Lindsay against a very obstreperous and colorful opponent, Mario Procaccino. And I got to be part of that whole election year. Jimmy Breslin, the famed columnist of the New York Daily News, was a regular. I'd be on the set with him and asking his opinions on so on. So it was a terrific if you make it here, you can make it anywhere kind of story for me at that time, my first year in New York. And, yes, tons of glamour and, lots of great music and getting into the jazz scene just something that I care about. And, it was very exciting, and I was thrilled to have a chance to be starting my American broadcast career, in New York.
Was that the year that Breslin ran for mayor?
No, that would have been a couple of years later.
Yeah.
But he was, I think, because he had such a presence as a columnist, and I don't know that he was ever really terribly serious about that. He was quite a character and a tremendous part of real New York. I think that's why he was so popular.
Yeah, I guess he and Norman Mailer, I guess they had a ticket.
Yeah.
So that's the other interesting part as I was reading your book is because you've been known for sports that you started out in news there at WPIX. In terms of the transition to sports, I mean, it just seems like it was inevitable. Was it at the time?
Well, yes. I had gone to Oakland with the hockey team in 1967, as I mentioned, and I felt my career then was okay. I'm in sports. This is what I want to do. I had the experience in news in Toronto when I was just starting out and wanting to be a news reporter. But by the time I got to New York, that was more luck of the draw. I had left the hockey team after the ownership changed in the first 2 years of the Seals in Oakland, and I was looking for work. And the job that I got offered was somebody who could do news anchoring and also be the sports guy, and they had learned about my journalism in Toronto and a little bit of news at CFTO every now and then, and so I was back doing news and sports, but my focus then, and especially when a new news director came in and decided that he wanted to keep me as a sports guy, but he was bringing in a new anchorman alongside. I'd rather going with one anchor instead of two, and I was a co-anchor when I first got there. So I was literally then out of the news business as an on-air guy. I just continued to be a news junkie, and I still am to this day.
You started broadcasting with the Islanders. Is that right?
In New York, the first hockey that I got to do there was with the Rangers, actually.
Oh, I see.
I did the Rangers road games. That came to me just kind of out of the blue because they were looking for a guy, and Emil Francis was then the general manager. He knew that I had worked the 2 years in Oakland and had come from Toronto, and he was the guy who said, I'd like you to do the Rangers TV road games for us. And then when NBC got the rights to the NHL Game of the Week, the executive producer had been watching me on the Rangers games and offered me that gig, and that's what got me into the networks And, you know, the rest, as I say, is history. I was at NBC until 1977. I went to CBS for 20 years and then back to NBC for the later part of my career.
Yeah. The book recounts a lot of your travels with your wife, Patricia, and your late wife, Lee. Have you been missing traveling, for lack of a better word, in this, say, COVID year?
Yes. I suppose I have a lot of company in that regard. I don't think our travel would ever be as much as it used to be, clearly, when I was working, and I was, you know, all of those stories that are in the book from that era. But even in retirement, which was in 2013, we continued to travel. I have a sister that lives in Ireland. We had lived part of the years in Switzerland for about over a span of 8 years. So we had made friends in Europe and France and Italy particularly. And so we would continue to travel, and I miss it. I haven't given up on it yet, but hopefully we'll be able to get back out there safely pretty soon. And certainly even I want to be able to go and visit my sister, now 92, doing very well, I'm happy to say, in Ireland, but you know, we like to keep an eye on her.
What, because the book is full of these marvelous stories of travels, is there a place that you haven't been to yet that you'd like to go to, say?
I think there are probably two or three. Some of them are more kind of, well, if it doesn't happen, that's okay.
Sure.
I really always wanted to get to Russia, and I kind of thought that with all of the sports that I was doing, that something would take me there and I could count on going there, and that didn't occur. The other part of the world that still fascinates me is India, and I was scheduled to do a tennis event there once that kind of came up out of the blue, and then it was, I forget the reason, but it was canceled, and so I didn't get to go there. But Russia, the history there, I was looking forward to going to St. Petersburg and seeing, you know, all of the great art and history there. So maybe we'll still have a chance to do that. But I guess some of the islands in the South Pacific, we've been to Australia and New Zealand, both in cases working trips for me. But there are still parts of the Southeast, like Tahiti and so on, that we'd kind of like to go and see.
I mentioned your wife, Lee. It's one of the more affecting parts of the book is when you write about her. And she was quite young when she was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. Is that right?
Yes. A classic case of what's known as the early onset. Mm. She was just 50 years old when it was discovered. And, of course, they don't know for sure until post-mortems. But most of the studies indicated that that's what we were dealing with, and turned out that was the case, and obviously a tremendously heart-rending event in our family, for not just for me but our four children. It was a difficult time, and in the beginning when we were just dealing with it, suddenly I'm asked to do some publicity things for it. And I wound up on the board of the National Alzheimer's Association, and I was happy to do it, but it was hard. Mm-hmm. It was hard to be talking about your own personal involvement, especially as she was alive for 11 years following the diagnosis.
How much better are we today, Tim, in terms of say, science, in terms of, say, managing the disease or even preventing it?
Well, I'd love to say that a lot of progress has been made. I can only say some. I think probably in identifying it and saying, yes, that's what it is when it occurs, there's a lot better, reach for that. But despite great efforts and great amounts of money being spent by top researchers around the world, it's unfortunate to say that really there hasn't been a major breakthrough in how to stop it, and actually have a cure, if you will.
Yeah. You tell a marvelous story in the book about the McEnroes, and not just John McEnroe, who you worked with in broadcasting, but John Sr. and Patrick. And I'm aware of them because I used to listen to Imus, and I guess Patrick was a regular on that show for a while. You were raising money for something, and they really came through, didn't they?
They did. In fact, it was an Alzheimer's fundraiser with funds going to the Alzheimer's Association. I was still on the board at that point and living in Sun Valley, Idaho, and I was a part owner of the minor league hockey team in Boise. So I was able to get the arena there to stage a fundraiser for the Alzheimer's Association. And my notion was to have an exhibition tennis event, which the first guy I asked was John McEnroe, because I had worked with him and was friendly with him, and he was quick to say, absolutely, I'll do it. He had met Lee, and, he was typically just generous and sympathetic and agreed to do it. We thought we had Pete Sampras, and he bailed on me, and that's when Patrick McEnroe jumped in with the assistance of his dad, just getting on the phone and saying, this happened at the last minute, the programs were printed, and suddenly, I'm about to lose the event. And his dad just called Patrick and said, you're going, 2 days from that time, to Boise, and you're going to be playing John for Tim Ryan. And I've been ever grateful to the whole family.
The other thing I was wondering about, Tim, as I was reading the book, there are a lot of photographs as well, and the uniform, if you will, the blazer with the patch of the network patch, which, by the way, only the guys in sports seem to wear. You never saw news guys wear that, did you?
That's right. I never thought of that. Did he say that? Yeah, I'm not sure what that's about. Why? I guess it would kind of look goofy on a news anchor, but I'm not so sure whether necessary on the sports broadcast. I guess just to remind people what channel they're watching.
Indeed. By the way, do you still have those patches, say, on your jackets?
I have a couple of them. It's funny you should ask that. I'm just looking around as I'm talking to you. I don't see them readily, but I do know I have a couple of them. They're in a box somewhere, I guess. Wait a minute, I just found one. That's WOR. That's the channel in New York that carried the Ranger games.
Oh yeah.
But I know I have some others.
Yeah.
That's funny you should ask.
When you were at CBS, your path obviously crossed with those in the news division. You knew Cronkite, and you write about Dan Rather. I want to ask about Rather because his sort of reputation seems to rise and fall on a regular basis. It rose a little bit in his opposition to Trump being so vocal on Twitter, and then it's sort of fallen in the last few weeks or so. I don't know if you heard that interview that Connie Chung gave talking about their relationship, if you will. You were there, I guess it was September 1987, the night he stormed off. I guess you threw to him, is that right?
That was quite an interesting time, and I'll come back, if you will mind me, to the Connie Chung thing, which I can kind of kick into, although I did not, I was not aware of what you just said about the recent comments. But going back to the first part of the story, which I talk about in the book, was that Dan was in Florida. He would normally be anchoring in New York, and I think it might have been a visit by a pope or something,
right,
that he was... He was on a set in another place where it makes sense for him to anchor from. And it was on the weekend of the U.S. Open Tennis women's semifinals. And I was anchoring the CBS coverage in New York at the U.S. Open and was preparing to throw to CBS News and Dan at the end of our time slot. However, the match ran longer and involved Chris Evert and I think it was Lori McNeil. I kind of forget who the opponent was, but it was a close throwing match, and it looked like it might be an upset, and so it ran long. So it's all live, and I've got a producer in my ear saying, we're going to stay with this. But you know, anything can happen. So, you know, we'll just stay in your ear, as they would say. Mm-hmm. And so when the news got to Rather in Miami that his new show was not going to start right on time, when I threw to it, he had walked off the set. Mm-hmm. So there was just an empty chair. And it was a bit of a cause celeb. It had nothing to do with Dan and I. It was just he was angry that, news was being interrupted by a tennis match. And so it was a bit of a cause celeb at the time. Oddly enough, he and I laughed about that a year or two later when he was helping me with a fundraiser for a wildlife group I was involved in, and that's also in the book.
Yeah.
He was a very generous guy, and we certainly had no animosity over that incident. We remained friends.
But I guess he and Connie did not remain friends after the CBS Evening News debacle.
Well, yes, and I don't remember all of the details of that, except there was the incident that I, because it involved me in an odd way, uh-huh. in a sad way, in every way, was at the Oklahoma City bombing,
mm.
and Dan was on vacation in Montana, I believe, somewhere. He had a place out there, and when the story broke, not unlike the recent one in Nashville in that respect,
yeah.
that it was all hands on deck. Connie, by just coincidence involving me, was in Sun Valley interviewing me for a special that CBS News was doing on Alzheimer's.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very difficult, painful thing for me at that time to even be doing the interview, but I consented to do it. It was my network, and you know, I knew it was good publicity for the Alzheimer's Association fundraising. And so in the midst of our doing some exterior walking shots, she got a phone call, and we were both told that about the Oklahoma City bombing.
Uh-huh.
And that they were on the phone for telling her, well, you need to get to Los Angeles, apparently, and Dan's going to go to Oklahoma City. And she said, I could hear her say, well, he's on vacation, isn't he? He's in Montana.
Yeah.
Well, he was, but he's going to Oklahoma City. And I could tell that she was angry
yeah.
about this. And meanwhile, I'm not in the best state of mind even doing this interview with her, and the whole thing just got stopped. Ultimately, they came back, it was a couple of weeks later, but I could tell from that incident and then what I learned from colleagues afterwards
yeah.
that this was the kind of, maybe the beginning or the middle of a breach between
yeah.
Connie and Dan that evidently goes to this day. Yeah. That part I didn't know until you told me.
Yeah, she did an interview with a podcaster. I'm trying to remember the name of the outlet. I think it's LA Magazine. And she was asked about who the most despicable person she's ever worked with. And
wow.
It was either that or who she would want to kill. I can't remember. I really can't remember. And then she said, I'd rather not say. And then the interviewer says, you're saving that. He says, no, I'd rather not say.
Oh, okay.
Meaning Dan Rather, you know.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, considering the guy she's married to is somewhat checkered. A career of programming choices.
Indeed.
Anyway, I won't go any further on that.
Yeah, the book is just fascinating because we get a great insight into what broadcasting really is and what made you so good at what you did for all those years. Do you miss it at all, Tim?
Well, yes, to the degree that when I'm watching some event, a sports event that. I'd like to be there to cover that kind of thing, but not terribly much. I mean, I got over the idea fairly quickly. I thought I might be doing one more Olympic Games, which would have been the Sochi Games,
mm-hmm.
Covering the ski racing there. But then when I watched it and talked to some of my many friends and colleagues who were there working the Olympics, then I thought, well, that's when I just as well I gave a miss. It was not fun for them to be there. The accommodations had all been hastily thrown together. It was not a pleasant atmosphere for people covering those games, according to my former friends at CBS. At NBC, pardon me. Every now and then, if I'm watching a Packers game, I'm a huge Aaron Rodgers fan. That would never come through on the air, of course. But, uh-huh. I'd say, boy, I'd love to be calling this great game today. But no, otherwise, I had had enough. I had a long run, and I had other things that I wanted to do, and the old cliche to being able to travel and spend more time with your family, the line goes. But my kids and grandkids are scattered around the U.S. and Canada, and so I was grateful, actually, that I was able to, start to enjoy the rest of my life. Yeah. And as you can see in the book, I have a lot of other interests, and it's given me time, more time to enjoy those.
But by the way, you mentioned the Sochi games. I guess that's those are the infamous the incidents with Matt Lauer, I guess, and the staff there. That's where a lot of that happened, I think.
Yeah, that I don't even know about that. I read the stories about Matt following that from the incidents and the offices in New York, but I'm not aware of. I didn't really talk to any of the NBC people after the Sochi games, except Kristen Cooper, my former ski partner, on ski racing, and she was the one who said, Tim, you didn't miss the experience that we've had elsewhere. It was not a pleasant place, but she probably didn't know anything, and I don't either about what you're referring to at Lauer.
I guess I just read that in the book, the book that came out on the whole thing with I can't remember his name now. Mia Farrow's kid. Ronan Farrow.
Oh, yeah. Okay, Ronan. Yeah. No, I know the book you're referring to now, but I didn't read that. And I knew Matt, just slightly as another NBC guy here and there, and we'd, have a brief chat, but I didn't really know him terribly well.
The other great thing about the book is when you talk about just what it's like to work for a network, this is big time broadcasting we're talking about, whether it's at NBC or CBS, about the executives. I found fascinating. Dick Ebersol was a fan of yours, but Sean McManus was not.
Well, it certainly appeared to me that way when McManus was going to take me off the U.S. Open tennis. When I had been promised that spot would be mine when Summerall left, by the previous president, Neil Tilson. And McManus didn't live up to that. He was ready to make Jim Nantz kind of the face of CBS Sports. And no offense to Jim at all, we were friends and remain so. But in fact, to the gentleman that he is, he came to me personally and he said, Tim, I want you to know I didn't ask for this. Mm-hmm. And I tried to say to them, you're the tennis guy and I'm a golf guy, but they told me, well, you want the contract, you're going to be the trainee at U.S. Open Tennis. So that was a bit of a conflict between me and McManus as a result of that. And my agent did the best he could to sort things, but I knew that it was, it was time to move on.
And for people listening to us, I guess McManus, he's the son of Jim McKay, is that right?
Yes, that's correct, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Who were some of the people that you admired, say, whether it was growing up or working early in the business that you liked, people of that vintage, say? Were there people that you looked up to that you even emulated, perhaps?
Well, that's a frequent question, I think, for all of us in the business, And I have said each time that I never had any idols, that I didn't think, that there was somebody who I want to be just like him or her. Mm-hmm. But the one who I admired the most and appreciated the most was Jack Whitaker. When in my years at CBS, I got to know Jack. He was kind of a senior guy at that time, and I loved how literate he was, and his writing was great, and he could capture the emotions and the scene of a sports event in ways that, you know, were so creative and over the top in terms of comparison to other announcers. And I just, boy, I wish I could do one of those one time, mm-hmm. like Jack does. But he's the only one who made that kind of an impact on me, because I wasn't looking to see, okay, I want to pattern myself after some play-by-play announcer on whatever sport. It was mainly about just trying to create Tim Ryan.
I've reached you in Victoria. What brought you back to Victoria after all these years?
Well, there were a few things, I'll just try to keep it short because it's not all that interesting, but we had lived previously to coming here in the Napa Valley. We had been there 5 years, and having moved there from Sun Valley, Idaho, and we were in the town of St. Helena. And it was just when the wildfires had really started to become an annual event in a serious way. Mm. We were threatened quite a bit in St. Helena, very close to our own home. And fortunately, no damage was done to that town, but I could see the fires on the horizon over some of the hill country where the vineyards are, over towards Sonoma County. And my wife, Patricia, was rightfully, very nervous about what lay ahead, since, the state was starting to expect a mm-hmm. fire season every year.
Right.
So that was part of it, that we thought, you know, maybe we should be looking elsewhere. Victoria was, there were friends of ours that go back to my Toronto days who had moved on. As I had gone to the States, so had they, for business reasons, and ultimately to England, and we visited them over the years, and he had retired around the same time I did, Lauren Duguid, his name, and his wife Margie, and they had decided that they were going to move to back to Canada, because they were Toronto people,
mm-hmm.
and they thought, let's go and take a look at Victoria, and they told me about it, and I said, well, you know, I visited there several times, and my parents lived there, and my late sister and her husband, and it's a beautiful place, and maybe we ought to take a look too. And so they really encouraged us to do that. And we came, visited a couple of times, and of course my brother-in-law was the husband of my late sister,
mm-hmm.
who had died young in her 50s, and he was very, he was like the PR guy for Victoria Living. He was born and raised here, a school teacher. He was a school principal here. And he is just a tremendous fan of this town, and he's lived here all his life. So he was working on us big time, too. And we came up, made two or three trips, and decided, wow, this, it's even better than I remembered. And the fact that my parents had lived here after my dad's retirement from the CFL football days, mm-hmm. that let's go and check it out. And we found a lovely spot, and we're very happy here.
Yeah, it's a beautiful city. As we were chatting just before we started, it's a city I miss too, not having been able to get there this year. When young people come up to you and want to go into sports, I'm sure they ask you for advice. Could someone today have the sort of career that you had straight out of college?
Well, I think yes, because actually cable television brought in many more opportunities mm-hmm. all those years ago, just after I had gotten started. And in those days, I would be talking to young people about saying, you know, your chances are better now than they were when I started, because, you know, it's a broader field of opportunity. I'm quick to say, you know, there's no formula to becoming a sports announcer or a news announcer, for that matter. And I recommend learning to be a good writer. So take journalism courses. And most of the time I think, well, don't I have to go into a broadcast school to make sure my voice is good?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that can help if your voice isn't, I suppose. But I'm a great believer in that being a good writer, and then learning the difference between writing for the ear as opposed to writing for the I.
Mm.
And if you can achieve those things, when you go to audition and you bring that to the attention of the people who are interested in you, I think it's a leg up immediately. And I think the opportunities are greater just because of the number of jobs available with the expansion of cable television and all of the new things that have occurred, streaming, et cetera.
Yeah, and that's the wonderful thing about your book, Tim, is that it really is written for not just the eye, but the ear, and that your voice comes through. I mean, I feel like I'm, as I'm reading parts of the book, I can hear you writing it, if you will. I mean, it's just...
It's just
so marvelously done like that.
I was conscious of that very early, and you mentioned Jimmy Breslin, and another writer at the time who became a TV guy was Dick Shapp, the late Dick Shapp.
Right.
And both of those guys I was lucky enough to get to know, and they didn't need kind of coaching from Tim Ryan. Believe me, they were already well-established writers. But where they did have a bit of a weakness until they learned more, particularly Dick, who had a longer broadcast career, was that something that, say, Jimmy could write for his fabulous column in the New York Daily News, if he was sitting in front of a camera and reading that off a teleprompter, it's not going to come across to the person listening as it would to the reader who can easily go back in a sentence or a paragraph and so on and soak up, the clever writing of a Breslin or a Dick Shapp.
Yeah, he really developed, I think, over the years, Breslin, that is, the personality for, say, television or radio. It was a different sort of vernacular that he used.
Yes, exactly. And I think you just, that's what I just try to tell young people, to be a good writer first. Study mm-hmm. creative writing, study reporting, and start with that point. And then if you're going to be telling that to somebody on a newscast on radio or television, you've got to be reading what you wrote and make sure that it's going to be heard, because they're not reading with you. It's going to be structured differently by you to make it easy for them to hear what you're saying.
Now, your book has been out for a while now. The feedback has been quite good, hasn't it?
It has. We haven't made the New York Times bestseller list with it, but we didn't expect to. It was aimed at an audience of more specific people who understand a career like mine. There's lots of sports announcers who write memoirs and they talk about the events they got to cover and tell you about how the Super Bowl game went or what have you, and that's fine. They certainly have not just to write, but they can make those interesting stories. But my career wasn't designed that way. I wanted to take advantage of covering many different sports just to keep myself, involved in lots of things and to get a chance to travel the world on someone else's nickel, which, is the title of the book. And I'm so grateful that things played out that way. I probably surrendered a bunch of money by not being more aimed at the studio hosting roles, which pay a lot more for FaceTime, as they call it. But, I wouldn't trade any of what I had chances to see the world and learn about different cultures and languages and cuisines and wines and wildlife. And it was a post-grad education.
Yeah, there's a wonderful list in the book of your favorite restaurants that you've been to over the years. A lot of them are no longer. 21, for example. I don't know. You heard that recently? That they're shut down now for good.
I did. It's hard for me to imagine that, and I keep saying in my heart, I just hope somebody doesn't come in and turn the space into an office building or something, and that hopefully somebody else will come along and say we can't close this up. I'll buy it and bring it back. It's quite a legendary place.
Yeah. The other thing, a great place. I was going to say restaurant because it's more than a restaurant. It's also a great saloon. PJ Clark's. You spent a lot of time there, didn't you?
Way too much. Yes, many, many late nights, and but yes, it was a great saloon. The owner, Danny Lovezzo, was a genuine character, even though he was an Italian in an Irish pub. And it was a meeting ground and a privilege to be allowed into the back room. They had a little guy who was like the cop back there, deciding who would get into the back room or not on any given night. And Frankie Ribondo, his name was. He ran that back room, and Danny Lovezzo, the owner, would be sitting at table one back there, and any given night there'd be movie stars or sports stars or lots of journalists and TV people, and it was a lot of fun.
I've been to New York, I guess, 3 times in the last 4 years. This is before COVID, obviously. And I went to P.J. Clark's twice because I just had to go, right? You know, that's where
yes.
Johnny Mercer wrote that song, right? At the bar.
That's exactly right.
And I swipe the check comes to you in this little card that you know, it's almost like a postcard of P.J. Clark. And I had to take it with me, you know, as a souvenir. And I have it framed here in my office. It just brings back so many memories. I could talk all day with you, Tim, about this book and about this remarkable life and career that you've led. It's not been with, you know, it's had its highs, obviously, but then, you know, it's had its lows as well. When you look back at it all, do you have regrets?
No, I don't. I really feel like I was just blessed to get the chance and get the opportunities that got me into the big leagues, if you will, and then to be able to, again, I keep coming back to it, but to see the world. I was always interested in other people, other mm-hmm. places, and, just learning what's out there. And the whole wildlife experience that kind of fell into my lap, meeting somebody at a cocktail party in New York, and my late wife and I getting involved on the board of this wildlife group at the time, and spending time in a totally different environment than I would have ever seen otherwise, and meeting wonderful, dedicated people there. Likewise, recently when we went on a trip to a wedding in Italy, because we had made friends in that country as well as many others, and going a long-awaited trip to La Scala, to the opera there, and those things all came about because of the kind of career I had as a sports broadcaster. Not just, being a network guy and making a nice living and, being able to send my kids to school and so on. It was a kind of career that took me around the world that I'll always be grateful for, and I have no regrets of not being a bigger star or a bigger name or have a bestseller book on the New York Times list.
Yeah, I've enjoyed the book and so appreciate you taking the time to chat with me about it. Continued good luck with the book, Tim. All the best.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed talking with you and being included amongst your very distinguished writers and other folks that you do this with. So thanks for including me.
The book is called On Someone Else's Nickel, A Life in Television, Sports, and Travel. It is published by Radius Book Group. It's author Tim Ryan joined me on the line from Victoria, British Columbia in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plata.